Namaskaram. Today there are several questions that were asked in previous months. Actually, these questions were asked back in July, but I didn't have time to answer them all last month. So I'll continue. All these questions are, to a greater or lesser extent, related to the practice of self-investigation, which, as we all know, is the central teaching of Bhagavan. That is, Bhagavan's teachings are all about practice. Bhagavan's teachings are focused on practice. The goal that Bhagavan has shown us is the eradication of ego. Eradication of ego alone is mukti. How to eradicate ego, that is what Bhagavan's teachings focus on. So Bhagavan's teachings are focused on the practice. So this is the very heart of Bhagavan's teaching that we're talking about today. The first question is asked by Sunil Goel. What he asks is, awareness is knowing, and I know I exist, and I also know that I am aware. Is this self-awareness? The answer is yes. When we say, I know I exist, I know I am aware, the I who is saying this is ego, which is that mixed awareness. I am this person. I am Sunil or Michael or whoever. But in this mixed awareness, I am Sunil or I am Michael, there is the essential element of this mixed awareness is the fundamental awareness I am. This fundamental awareness I am is what we are aware of in all three states. That is, we are that awareness, which is aware of itself as I am. So we always know that we exist, and we always know that we are aware. And this knowledge, this awareness of our existence and our awareness is what is called self-awareness. This is what we actually are. There is, and this alone is real, because all other things, including the ego, appear and disappear, whereas this underlying fundamental awareness of our own existence is what alone exists and shines in all states and in all times. So this is what we actually are, and this is what we are seeking to know. Of course, we always know I am. The problem is now, instead of knowing just I am, we know this I am mixed and conflated with adjuncts. We know ourselves as I am Sunil or I am Michael or I am whoever. Because of this mixed awareness, which is what is called ego, we are not aware of ourselves as we actually are. So the whole purpose of Bhagavan's teaching, the whole purpose of this practice of self-investigation and self-surrender is to know ourselves as we actually are. How do we know ourselves as we actually are? So long as we are attending to anything other than ourselves, what is aware of the existence of things other than itself is only ego, that which is aware of itself as I am this body, I am this person. So long as we are aware of anything other than ourselves, we are not aware of ourselves as we actually are. So in order to be aware of ourselves as we actually are, we need to be aware of ourselves and ourselves alone. For that, we need to attend to ourselves very keenly. Because of the strength of our Vishayavasanas, our inclination to attend to other things, we are not willing yet to entirely let go of other things. So we need to persevere in this practice of trying to hold on to self-attentiveness, trying to be attentively aware of ourselves as just being. By trying to be so self-attentive, we are slowly weakening our Vishayavasanas and strengthening our Satvasana. So we become, we our love to know and to be what we actually are increases, and we are thereby freed from, to the extent that our love to know and to be ourself increases, to that extent, our desire and attachment for other things will decrease. So in other words, as the bhakti grows, the vairagya will also grow. So this is why we need to persevere in this practice until we remain just as pure awareness. Not in other words, until the adjuncts drop off entirely and we are aware of ourselves just as satchit, as mere being, mere awareness, which is itself ananda, which is itself pure love. Until we know ourselves as such, we need to persevere in this practice. So, but the what we are seeking to know is what we always know. But instead of knowing ourselves, though we always know ourselves, though we are always self-aware, we are not aware of ourselves as we actually are because we mistake ourselves to be this set of adjuncts, the five sheaves, this body, life, mind, intellect, and will. So long as we mistake ourselves to be this bundle of five sheaves that we call a person, we are not aware of ourselves as we actually are. And consequently, we're aware of other things and we face so many difficulties and problems. So yes, what the simple answer to Sunil's question is yes, self-awareness, awareness is knowing, and knowing our own existence and our own awareness, in other words, knowing ourselves is self-awareness, just being aware of ourselves, being aware I am. That is what is meant by self-awareness, and that is what we need to attend to, that fundamental awareness of our own existence. That's what we need to attend to in order to withdraw our attention from all other things and thereby merge back in the source from which we rose. The next question is one asked by Sushil Motwani. This is also a very suitable question to follow on from this previous one. The question is a thoughtless state the same as holding on to the I thought? The simple answer is no. There's a thoughtless state, a state free of thoughts that we experience every day. It's called sleep. How do we go to sleep when we are too tired to continue thinking of things other than ourselves? We withdraw our attention from all other things and thereby subside into sleep. We do so effortlessly just because of the tiredness. So the fact that we experience sleep every day, that shows that merely being free of thoughts is not our aim. If we remain without thoughts, that leads to that is the state without thought is called manolaya. But that is that we cannot make any spiritual progress in the state of manolaya. In order to know what we actually are, we not only have to give up knowing other things, we have to know ourselves. This is what Bhagavan says in teaches in verse 16 of Upadeshundia. What he says in verse 16 of Upadeshundia is vele videngale vittu, leaving external phenomena. So it's necessary to stop thinking of other things, but merely stopping thinking of other things is insufficient. So that he put this leaving external phenomena, it is just an adverbial clause. It's not the main clause. The main clause is manam tan oli uru ordale unme unichyam. That is, the mind knowing its own form of light is true awareness, a real awareness. What does he mean by the mind knowing its own form of light? Light is a metaphor for awareness. So the mind knowing itself as pure awareness, that is a real awareness. Why does he say the mind knowing? That is, pure awareness always knows itself. Can pure awareness be an object known by the mind? No, obviously not. But when the mind knows that pure awareness, that pure awareness means that fundamental awareness of its own existence, I am, when the mind knows that, it ceases to be a mind and remains as that pure awareness. So this is what self-investigation is all about. It's not merely letting go of other thoughts. In yoga, for example, the aim in yoga, yogas chitta vritti nirodha, Yoga is the restraint of Nirodha means, yes, the restraint of the citta vrittis. So if we bring about the subsidence of citta vrittis, that is the aim of yoga. But that results in a state that they call nivikalpa samadhi, which, as Bhagavan clarified, is just a state of manolaya. It is not sufficient by itself. So it's not just a matter of letting go of other thoughts. We need to hold on to ourself. Bhagavan, though our aim is to know what we actually are, Bhagavan often describe this practice as holding on to ego or holding on to the thought called I. The thought called I is just another way of describing ego, because ego is nothing but a thought. But though it's a thought, it's like unlike all other thoughts, because all other thoughts are objects and they're jada, whereas ego is the only thought that is endowed with awareness. So it is a thought, but it's a thought unlike all other thoughts. That is why ego is called chit jada granti. It is a conflation of chit, the pure awareness, and jada, these five sheaves that constitute the body or person that we take ourselves to be, but not formed by the entanglement of these two. So, but when we try to investigate ego or this thought called I, we are not trying to investigate the adjuncts, these five sheaves. We are trying to investigate only the fundamental awareness that, in other words, the real aspect of ego, that is I am. So whether we say we are investigating our real nature or investigating ego, it amounts to the same thing. This we can understand with a simple analogy. Supposing we are walking along a path in the dim light of dusk with Bhagavan, and we see on the path ahead of us something lying on the path ahead of us, which we take to be a snake, and we are afraid, and we say, oh, Bhagavan, there's a snake there. Bhagavan assures us, no, it's not a snake, it's only a rope. But still we are not fully convinced, because to us it looks very much like a snake, so we're still not able to dispel our fear entirely. Then Bhagavan says to us, look at it carefully. Look at it carefully. Does that mean, is he telling us to look carefully at the snake or at the rope? It doesn't matter. So long as we think it's a snake, he will tell us, look at the snake. When we look at the snake, what do we see? Oh, it's just a rope. So what the snake that we thought we were looking at is actually just a rope. So whether we say we are looking at the snake or looking at the rope, it's the same thing. Likewise, whether we say we're holding on to ego or the thought called I, or we're holding on to our own real nature, it amounts to the same thing, because there is only one I. That one I, when it appears as I am this or I am that, is called ego or the thought called I. When it remains just as pure I am, that is what we actually are, but there's only one I. So holding on to this one I is the aim of our practice. And it's only by holding on to this one eye, whether we call it the thought called I or the pure or the fundamental awareness I am, it amounts to the same thing. Holding on to I alone is the means to bring about manonasa. As I say, if we just give up thoughts, which yogis do by techniques like pranayama and various meditation techniques and so on, they're able to enter a state free of thoughts. But that state is just manolaya. It's a dissolution of the mind, but only a temporary dissolution of the mind. Our aim is not to bring about a temporary dissolution of mind, because we do that every day when we fall asleep. That doesn't solve our problems. Because when the mind dissolves in laya, sooner or later it will rise again. As Bhagavan says in the verse 13 of Upadesha Undia, but the dissolution of mind is of two kinds, laya and nasa. That which is in laya will rise again. That which dies in nasa will not rise again. So our aim is manonasa. And manonasa is brought about not by merely giving up thoughts, but by holding on to my first thought called I. But there's a deep reason for this. That is, when we go into a state of manolaya, for example, sleep, why do we go into sleep? We go into sleep because we are too tired to continue thinking. So we subside in sleep. In the case of yogis who go into Nirvikalpa Samadhi, they go into that state of manolaya by techniques such as pranayama and various meditation techniques and so on. But the reason the resulting state is a state of manolaya, not manonasa, is because they go into that state by, if we go into any, if the mind is dissolved by any means other than self-aware, other than being aware of ourselves as we actually are, what happens is first mind and ego, when it said mano layer, it means layer of ego, because ego is the essential element of the mind. What the mind actually is ego. As Bhagavan said, of all the thoughts of the mind, the first thought is the thought called I. So this I thought or ego, this is the essence of the mind. So when the mind dissolves in layer, what happens is first, through some means other than knowing ourselves, ego subsides. As a result of a subsidence of ego, what remains is just pure awareness. That is what we experience in Nirvikalpa Samadhi or in sleep or in any other state of pure awareness is just pure, in any other state of manolaya is just pure awareness. That is, we remain as we actually are, as pure awareness. But ego is not thereby destroyed. Why is that? Because ego is nothing but a false awareness of ourself. An awareness of ourself is something other than what we actually are. So ego can be destroyed only by being aware of itself as it actually is. Since in manolaya, what happens is first ego subsides and dissolves back into its source, and then what remains is pure awareness. Since ego is absent, that pure awareness doesn't destroy ego. So in order to bring about the destruction of ego, we need to bring about the pure awareness should not be a result of the subsidence of ego, it should be the cause of the subsidence of ego. In other words, we as ego need to be aware of ourselves as we actually are. By being aware of ourselves as we actually are, we thereby cease to be ego. In other words, ego is eradicated and we remain just as we actually are. So the pure awareness needs to be experienced by ego. But in manolaya, first ego subsides and then pure awareness alone remains. But when ego experiences itself as pure awareness, it ceases to be ego, because ego is not pure awareness. Ego is the adjunct mixed awareness. I am this body. I am this person. Body consisting of five sheaves. So this is why holding on to I is absolutely essential. It's only by attending to ourselves that we can bring about the dissolution of ego. Because when we attend to ourselves, the more we attend to ourselves, the more other things, thoughts and phenomena, they all drop off. And all the adjunct that we now mistake ourselves to be, they all drop off. And what remains is just pure awareness. When we as ego thereby experience ourselves as pure awareness, ego is destroyed, and that is the state of manonasa. That is, we can explain this in terms of when we are attending to other things, our attention is turned away from ourselves towards those other things. So when we are practicing self-investigation, we are trying to turn our attention back towards ourselves. To the extent to which we turn back towards ourselves, we are thereby turning away from other things. So we, so to speak, we have to turn 180 degrees. Obviously not literally, but we can describe it as turning 180 degrees. That is, we're turning away from other things back towards ourselves. When we are practicing, because of the strength of our Vishaya Vasanas and our resulting likes, dislikes, desires, attachments, and so on, we are not yet entirely willing to let go of everything else. So we are not turning the full 180 degrees. we may be turning 10 degrees, 20 degrees, 50 degrees, 90 degrees, 120 degrees, but we are not yet turning the full 180 degrees. So until we turn 180 degrees, there's still some awareness of things other than ourselves. Even when we turn 179 degrees, our attention is almost entirely fixed on ourselves, there's still some lingering attention on other things. There's still some slight awareness of things other than ourselves. But when we turn the full 180 degrees, we're aware of ourselves alone. We're not aware of anything else whatsoever. When we're aware of ourselves alone, being aware of ourselves alone, that is the state of pure awareness, because pure awareness means being aware of nothing other than ourselves. So when we as ego experience ourselves with pure awareness, as soon as we experience ourselves with pure awareness, we cease to be ego. This is why in verse 16 of Upadesha Undia that I referred to earlier, Bhagavan says, Manam Tanoli Uruodale, the mind knowing its own form of light. So, of course, in sleep, we know our own form of light, but it's not there. It's the mind's form of light is knowing itself, because the mind is absent. It's a state of manole, dissolution of mind. So the mind has to know its own form of light. In other words, the mind has to know itself as pure awareness. You may be more familiar with the Sanskrit version of that verse. What Bhagavan says in Sanskrit is Drisya Varitam. Drisya Varitam means giving up the drishya, or withdrawing the attention from the drishya. That's what Drisya Varitam implies. Drisya Varitam, chittam atmanaha. The chittam there means mind. Chittam atmanaha means its own. Chitva darshanam, the mind. Seeing its own chitva, its own awareness. That is what Bhagavan refers to in Tamil as Oliyuru, the form of light, the mind's own form of light, Tan Oliyuru. In Sanskrit, he refers to as Atmanaha Chitva Darshanam, the chittam, the mind, seeing its own form of light. That is tattva darshanam, that is seeing the reality. So if we want to see ourselves as we actually are, we need to see our own chitva, our own form of light, our own fundamental awareness, our own that pure awareness I am. We need to see that and that alone. So we need to completely give up all the drishya, everything that is seen, all objects, all phenomena, we need to give up. And we need to see only ourselves as pure awareness. So in both the Tamil and the Sanskrit, Bhagavan says the mind knowing it. In Tamil, he says the mind knowing its own form of light. In Sanskrit, he says the mind, the chittam, knowing its own chitva, its own fundamental awareness. So that is the means to bring about the annihilation of ego. So many people think that if we can remain without thoughts, that is being self-attentive. No, that is not so. We remain without thoughts in sleep. We remain without thoughts in Nirvikalpa Samadhi, but we don't thereby know ourselves as we actually are. In order to know ourselves as we actually are, we need to attend to ourselves. And when we're in a state of manolaya, there's no ego to attend to anything, so we can't attend to anything. There's just in the state of manolaya, what remains is only pure awareness. What is the difference between manolaya and manonasa? The experience in that state is exactly the same, but the difference is, because in manolaya it's only a temporary dissolution of the mind or ego, it will rise again, whereas in manonasa it is permanent. The mind is destroyed once for all. Because when ego sees itself as pure awareness, it sees that it's never anything other than pure awareness. And therefore, there never was any such thing as ego. That is, though that state is called the state of manonasa, destruction of ego, of mind, it's even that is not entirely correct. It's metaphorically described as destruction of mind, but actually it is seeing that there was no such thing as mind at all. As Bhagavan says in verse 17 of Upadesha Undia, Manati Nuruve Maravadu Chava Manamena Mondrile Undipara Markum Neragamidi Undipara. When one investigates the form of the mind, the form of the mind means this first thought I, without forgetfulness, manomeno mandule, there's no such thing as mind at all. In Sanskrit, he says, manasam tu kim, margane krite, neva manasam, margamajavat. This is the direct path. So in both the Tamil and Sanskrit, Bhagavan says that if we investigate this mind, that means if we investigate this thought called I, we'll find there's no such thing at all. What is there is only that form of light which we actually are, only that chitva. That state is metaphorically called manonasa, it is actually not even manonasa, because there's no, it is the realization that there was never any such thing as mind or ego at all. We are always pure awareness and nothing other than that. That is what we actually are, is only sat chit ananda. We are that even now. We are never anything other than that. But in the view of ego, we seem to have limited ourselves as I am this person. I am Sushil, or I am Michael, or whoever. So all we need to do is to see ourselves without adjuncts. As Bhagavan says in verse 25 of Upadeshundia, Tanne Upadi Vittu Orvadu, knowing oneself, leaving adjuncts. That means knowing oneself without adjuncts, Adutan, that itself is Isan Tanne Unavadam. That is knowing God. Because God is our own self without adjuncts. When we see ourselves without adjuncts, that is seeing God. So our aim is to be aware of ourselves as we actually are. In other words, to be aware of ourselves without adjuncts. How to be aware of ourselves without adjuncts? By attending only to ourselves and not anything else. When we attend only to ourselves and not anything else, the awareness of all other things, including all the adjuncts that we take ourselves to be, will drop off because we're not attending to them. And then we are aware of ourselves as pure awareness, and that alone is true knowledge. That is alone is tattva-darshanam or unmayonachi. Tattva-darshanam means we're seeing the reality. Unmayonachi means, it can mean awareness of what is real or real awareness. Either way, it amounts to the same thing. So that's the second question. The next question is asked by Murali Mahadevan. His question is, how does one distinguish between the dualistic peace that one feels during the absence of thoughts and the peace that is the real nature of the self? Firstly, we need to be clear about what we mean by absence of thoughts. Thoughts are absent only in manolaya or manonasa. During waking and dream, thoughts are always present. People think that often mistake thoughts to mean just mental chatter. We are constantly having a conversation with ourselves in our own mind. That they are verbalized thoughts constantly going through our mind. When we sit for meditation, we are able to withdraw our mind from those verbalized thoughts, but they are not the only thoughts. All mental modifications, all chitta vrittis, all manovrittis, all every modification of the mind is a thought. So all mental phenomena are thoughts. So when we are sitting in meditation without mental chatter, we may mistake that to be a state of free from thoughts, but it is not a state. It is a state in which the mental we are free from the mental chatter, and therefore the mind may be in a relatively calm and peaceful state, but it's not entirely free from thoughts. Even the I that is meditating is itself a thought. And the idea I am meditating is a thought. And the idea that I'm meditating for 20 minutes and I'm sitting here and I'm feeling a little bit uncomfortable, but I'm bearing with the discomfort, or the mosquitoes are biting me, I'm trying to ignore them because I'm trying to be without thoughts. All that is thoughts. That is, awareness of anything other than ourself is a thought. That's why Bhagavan says the whole world is nothing but thoughts. Jagam Embadu Nineve, he says in the 14th paragraph of Nana, what is called the world is nothing but thought. And in the fourth paragraph, he says, if you remove all thoughts and see, there's no such thing as mind separately. So the mind is nothing but thought. And he says, excluding all thoughts, there's no such thing as world. So the world is nothing but thoughts. It's nothing, just like in dream, we see a world, but that world we see in a dream is nothing but our own thoughts. Likewise, the world we see now is nothing but our own thoughts. The world is nothing but perceptions, five kinds of perceptions, sights, sounds, tactile sensations, smells, and tastes. If you remove all these five, there's no such thing as world. That's why Bhagavan says sixth verse of Uludhunapadu, the world is nothing but the five kinds of sense impression, but nothing else. He said, Verandru is nothing but those five kinds of sense impression. So what Bhagavan means by thought is, he means thought. All objects, all phenomena are thoughts. And even the subject, the one who is aware of all phenomena, is itself a thought. That is the first thought, i.e. ego. So we are not truly free of thoughts, except in Manolaya or Manonasa. When we are asleep, sleep is a state that is free of thoughts. We're not aware of anything other than ourselves. We're aware only of I am and nothing other than I am. Everything other than that pure awareness I am is a thought. So if we're aware of anything other than I am, we are aware of thought. So what you refer to as the dualistic peace that one feels in the absence of thoughts, what you're referring to is that relative peace that we experience when the mind is relatively quiet, when the mind is agitated by thoughts to a lesser extent. But as I said in answer to Sushil's question, merely being free of thoughts is not our aim. So when to the extent to which thoughts subside, to that extent we experience peace. But the peace that is our real nature, that is the peace we experience in the relative absence of thought, the relative peace we experience in the relative absence of thought is only a relative peace. It is not other than the peace which is our real nature, but it is not the, so long as it's something that seems to come and go, it is not, just like the sun may seem to appear and disappear when the clouds go past, the peace that we actually are seems to come and go because of the movement of the mind. So long as it seems to come and go, we are not experiencing that peace in its pure condition. Only when we are aware of nothing other than ourselves are we truly experiencing the infinite peace that is our own real nature. Because many people take the aim of meditation merely to be free of thoughts, they try to exclude thoughts, which in most cases, I say, they're just excluding the more superficial thoughts, the mental chatter and so on. But still, they're not in a state totally free of thoughts. Because people take trying to be free of thoughts as the aim of meditation, when they experience peace or happiness or whatever as a result of excluding thoughts to at least to a certain extent, they take that as the aim of meditation. That is not the aim. The aim of true meditation is only to know ourselves. That is why Bhagavan says the best meditation of all is only meditating on ourselves, not meditating on anything other than ourselves. So long as we're meditating on anything other than ourselves, we are still in the realm of thought. So if we want to be free of thought, we need to attend only to the first thought I, because the nature of all other thoughts, by attending to anything other than ourselves, we are thereby nourishing and strengthening ego. But when we attend to ego, the first thought I, its nature is to subside. That is, we rise, stand, and flourish as ego, by attending to things other than ourselves. This is what Murali, I think you may know Tamil because from your name. Well, this is what Bhagavan says in verse 25 of Uludunaptu. He's talking about ego, which he describes as Uruvatrapeyahande, formless phantom ego. He says, Urupatri Undam, grasping form, it comes into existence. Urupatri Nikam, grasping form, it stands. Urupatri Undu Mika Ongam, grasping and feeding on forms, it flourishes abundantly. Uruvittu Urupatram, leaving form, it grasps form. That means leaving one form, it grasps another form. Tadinal Otam Pidikam, if sought, it takes flight. That, what does he imply thereby? Grasping, since ego is a formless phantom, all the forms we grasp are things other than ourselves. So all thoughts, all phenomena are forms. So attending to anything other than ourselves is grasping form. And by grasping form, we rise as ego, we stand as ego, and we flourish abundantly. Mika ongam, Bhagavan says it. So this is the nature of ego. If instead of trying to grasp form, we try to grasp ourselves, what happens? Ego subsides and disappears. This is what he means by tadinal otam pidikam. If sought, it takes flight. So in other words, we seem to be ego only so long as we're looking at other things. If we look at ourselves, ego will subside and disappear because there's no such thing as ego at all. Ego seems to exist only so long as we're looking at other things. If we look at ourselves, ego will subside and disappear. That's what he means by otam pidikam. It will take flight. It'll run away. It'll disappear. That's just a metaphorical way of saying it'll subside. It'll subside and dissolve back into its source. So, since the nature of ego is to rise, stand, and flourish by attending to anything else, but to subside and dissolve back into its source by attending to itself, how can we free ourselves from all thoughts in such a way that they'll never rise again? Only by attending to ego. Otherwise, if we're merely trying to get rid of thought, the most we can achieve is a state of manolaya. We cannot achieve manonasa except by holding on to this first thought eye. In other words, by investigating ourselves, who am I? This is the only way to bring about manonasa. So when we are practicing meditation, we are not looking for any experience that comes and goes. That is, we may experience peace, we may experience joy, we may have all sorts of sublime experiences while meditating. But so long as those experiences seem to come and go, they are not our real nature, because our real nature is that which never comes nor goes, which is always shining clearly as I am. So our aim is not to, older Advaitic texts, Shankara, for example, Adi Shankara in Aparokshanubhuti, when he talks about the obstacles that can occur when we are practicing this, the first obstacle he says is I think something like Anushtana Rahitam, that is being without. Anusantana. Anusantana means investigation. It means Atma Anusantana, self-investigation. So letting go of the self-attentiveness is the first obstacle. But as a result of that, so many other obstacles also arise. One of the obstacles, he says, is bliss. When meditating, we may enjoy all sorts of sublime states. We may experience great peace, great bliss. But so long as that is something that comes and goes, it is not the reality. What is real can never come and can never go, because it is always exists and shines as it is. What exists and shines without ever coming and going? Only our fundamental I, awareness I am. So long as that peace seems to come and peace or bliss or whatever it is, seems to come and go, it seems to be something other than I. Because whatever comes and goes has to be other than I, because I is what always exists and shines. So it is not the real peace that we are seeking. in order to achieve the real peace that we are seeking, we need to go beyond, we need to hold only on to what is always existing and always shining. That is I am. So whatever we may experience when meditating is not, if it comes, it will go. It is not, therefore not real. What we are trying to hold on to, only that which neither appears nor disappears, which is always existing and always shining, that is I am. And only when we hold on to I am so firmly that we thereby let go of everything else, in other words, we turn the full 180 degrees, then we will dissolve back into that I am and remain as we always are, as that I am. And that is the true infinite eternal peace that never comes and never goes, because it is our own very nature. We can never be anything other than that. We seem to have lost that peace only because we've risen as ego and thereby limited ourselves as this person. I am Murali, or I am Michael, or I am whoever. So I hope this adequately answers that question. So anything that comes and goes is not real. So if peace seems to come and go, though it is a reflection of the infinite peace that is our own real nature, it is not our own real nature, because our own real nature is that which never comes and never goes, because it is always shining without break, as it is eternal. It is whatever comes and goes cannot be real. As Bhagavan used to say, whatever exists at one time and not at another time doesn't actually exist, even when it seems to exist. So what actually exists must always exist. And what actually exists is only our own real nature. As he says in the seventh paragraph of Nana, yathātamai uladu, what actually exists, atma-swarūpa-mandre, is atma-swarūpa alone. Atma-swarūpa means the real nature of ourself. So what we actually are, that alone is what is real. Everything else comes and goes. So our aim in meditation is not to experience anything that comes or anything that goes. In fact, we shouldn't be concerned about things that come and go. We shouldn't even be concerned about thoughts. When we're trying to meditate, we shouldn't be trying to be free of thoughts. Bhagavan says in the sixth paragraph of Nana, ettene enangal erinam enna, however many thoughts arise, so what? Big deal. What does it matter? We are not to be concerned with thoughts. What he says in the next sentence, as and when each thought arises, if one investigates to whom it arises, the attention will turn, it will be clear to me. And thereby investigating who am I, the mind will turn back to its source, and the mind will return to its source, and the thought that arisen will subside. So being free of thoughts is a byproduct of being self-attentive. It's not our aim. So long as we make our aim to be free of thoughts, if you want to be free of thoughts, you need to think about thoughts in order to be free of them. So our attention shouldn't be on thoughts at all. Our attention should be only on ourselves. If there's any thought you want to attend to, attend only to the thought called I. In other words, ego, the first thought. If you attend to it, because all other thoughts will feed ego. If you attend to ego, it will subside and disappear. Tadinal otum pidicum. If thought, it takes flight. So our sole aim when meditating should be to try to attend only to ourselves and nothing other than ourselves. So let thoughts come and go. It's no concern of ours. Let the world appear or disappear. It's no concern of ours. Let peace or bliss or anything else come and go. It's no concern of ours. The only thing we are concerned with is knowing what is ever existing and ever shining. That is only I am. So that is meditation as taught by Bhagavan. That is what Bhagavan calls for Rupa Darshanam, meditation on our own real nature. If we're meditating on our own real nature, we need not be concerned about thoughts. Let thoughts come and go. They're not, thoughts are a problem only if we attend to them. Why should we attend to them? Our aim is to attend only to ourselves. So I hope that adequately answers your question, Murali. The next question was asked by someone called Astral Light 333. What that person says is, I had an experience when only witnessing was taking place. There was no witness. It's hard to explain. Do you have anything to say about it? Well, the first thing to say about it is there cannot be any witnessing without a witness, obviously. I mean, because without witnessing means knowing or being aware of. How can there be any knowing or being aware of anything if there's not something that is knowing or being aware? So there cannot be any witnessing without a witness. That is the first thing to understand. It may seem to you that it was a state without a witness, because if you're so absorbed either in what you're witnessing or in the act of witnessing it, you may overlook the fact that who is witnessing? I am. So you, when you said I had an experience, the I that had the experience is the witness of that experience. There cannot be any experience without an I who experiences it. The I who experiences it is the witness. So there's no such state. But our witnessing is not our aim. When you're witnessing means, well, witnessing as it's usually understood means witnessing whatever appears and disappears. But whatever, so witnessing involves attending to things other than ourselves. If you want to witness anything, you should witness only the witness. In other words, the witness should attend only to itself. It shouldn't be attending to other things. So long as we're attending to other things, we are feeding and nourishing ego, because the nature of ego is to rise, stand, and flourish by attending to things other than itself. So long as we're attending to anything other than ourselves, we are just feeding and nourishing ego. So witnessing is not our aim. This term witness, Sakshi, is used in scriptures in two senses. Bhagavan said it's very important to distinguish two senses in which the term witness is used. If by witness you mean the knower, that which is knowing anything other than itself, that witness is only ego. If by witness, sometimes Brahman is referred to as Sarva Shakti, Sakshi, the witness of all. In that context, when Brahman or Atmasurupa, when our own real nature is referred to as witness, their witness is used in a different sense, not in the sense of the knower, but in Bhagavan said, in such context, Sakshi means sanadi, the presence in which everything is known. That is sometimes referred to as witness. So witness there means that light of awareness in which all these things appear, not that to which they appear. Everything appears, all things that are witness, all things that appear only in the view of ourself as ego. In the view of our real nature, which is pure awareness, there is nothing other than pure awareness, so there's nothing to witness. But in the present, that pure awareness is the light that illumines the mind and thereby enables the mind or ego, thereby enabling it to witness other things. So we need to, this term, there's a lot of confusion about this term witness, because people don't fail to distinguish these two senses in which the term witness is used. That's why that's a very important teaching of Bhagavan. But if witness means the knower, that is ego. If witness means the presence, the awareness in the presence of which everything appears and disappears in the view of ego, that in that sense, witness is only pure awareness, which is never aware of anything other than itself. That is, the pure awareness is the light that illumines the mind, and it's only the mind or ego that is aware of other things. It's never the pure awareness is never aware of anything other than itself. This is again something that there's a lot of confusion about. If you listen to traditional exponents of Advaita, they will often refer to pure awareness witnessing other things, but that is not so. Pure awareness, the nature of pure awareness is not doing anything, it is just being. So when we remain as we actually are, we're not aware of anything other than ourselves, anything other than our own being. When we're aware of anything other than ourselves, we're aware of ourselves as ego. As Bhagavan says, for example, in verse 4 of Uludhanapadu, Bhagavan says, Uruvam tanayin uluhu paramatran. If oneself is a form, the world will be, and God will be likewise. If oneself is not a form, who can see their form and how? So it's only when we rise as ego and take ourselves to be the form of the body that we are aware of all other forms. Forms here doesn't mean just the physical forms of the world, all the thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, likes, dislikes, desires, attachments, all the anything that can be distinguished from any other thing is a form, whether subtle or gross. So long as we're aware of anything other than ourselves, we who are aware of that are ego. So in that, if we take ego to be, if we refer, by the term witness, we mean that which is aware of other things, that is only ego. If by witness we mean that pure awareness in the light of which all, in the presence of which all other things appear, then that is our real nature. So our real nature never witnesses anything other than itself. And so long as we are witnessing anything other than ourselves, we as ego are there as the witness. That is, it's only in such context, it's only ego that is the witness, because only ego ever knows anything other than itself. So I hope this clarifies it. Just one more thing. The very fact that you say that you had an experience when only witnessing was taking place and that there was no witness shows that you were overlooking your own existence. You were so absorbed in what you were witnessing, or in your act of witnessing it, that you were overlooking the fact that you were there as the witness. But the very fact that you say, I had an experience, means that you were there as the witness of that experience. There cannot be witnessing without a witness. Then the next question is asked by Bethune Velamati. What she asks is, how does one overcome headaches during self-inquiry? Headaches are phenomena. They're things that come and go. Whatever we experience in our present life, whatever, anything other than ourselves that we experience, is the fruit of past karmas, and it is what has been allotted for us to experience in this lifetime as our prarabdha. So headaches come and go according to prarabdha. If there's a remedy for your headache, supposing you take some tablet that relieves your headache, just like the headache came according to prarabdha, the remedy also came according to prarabdha. But so long as it's your destiny to have a headache, you will have a headache. When it's your destiny to be relieved of a headache, you'll be relieved of headache. This has nothing to do with self-investigation, self-inquiry. If a headache occurs while you're doing self-inquiry, it may seem to you that your self-inquiry is the cause for that headache. It is not. That headache has come according to prarabdha. So how can self-inquiry help in such situations? When we self-inquiry or self-investigation, avichara, means we are trying to attend only to ourselves. So if we, whatever we may experience, whether it's a headache or any other perception, any other sensation, any other anything other than ourselves, anything that comes and goes, to whom does it appear? It appears only to me. So when the headache comes, we shouldn't be concerned about the headache. We should be concerned about who am I who is aware of this headache. So we should turn our attention away from the headache back towards ourselves. To the extent to which we attend only to ourselves, we will cease to be aware of the headache. So the way to deal with the headache is to stop attending to the headache and attend only to oneself, the one who has the headache. So if it's our prarabdha to experience a headache, we cannot avoid that experience. What we can avoid is avoid attending to it by attending only to ourselves. To the extent to which we attend to ourselves, we then thereby don't attend to whatever experiences come and go according to prarabdha. So as Bhagavan often said, prarabdha affects only the outward term mind, not the inward term mind. So when we are being self-attentive, we are thereby not attending to whatever experiences come according to prarabdha. So we'll be unaffected by them. Whereas if we are turning our attention outwards, that means if we're attending to anything other than ourselves, we then have to experience whatever we are destined to experience. So the only way to overcome destiny is to attend to ourselves. Because to the extent to which we attend to ourselves, we are not thereby changing what is to happen, what is to be experienced. We are thereby just withdrawing our attention from it by focusing our attention on ourselves. When we attend to ourselves keenly enough, ego will thereby destroy, and therefore all experiences will come to an end, because all experiences, all the three karmas, agamya, sanchitta, and prarabdha, agamya is the actions that we do under the sway of our vasanas. Those actions bear fruit, which are stored in sanchitta, and that are later allotted for us to experience in prarabdha. So, as Bhagavan says in verse 38 of Uludhanaptu, if we are the doer of actions, we will have to experience the resulting fruits. Vine mudal namayin, vile payan tuipom. If we are the doer of actions, we will have to experience the resulting fruit. But if the doership, but if as a result, if one knows oneself by investigating who is the doer, doership will depart, implying along with doership, the experiencership will depart, because doership and experiencership are the nature of ego. So when we know what we actually are, ego will thereby disappear. Therefore, its doership and its experiencership will disappear. Therefore, all three karmas will cease to exist. All three karmas will drop off, he says. So gamya, sanchitta, and prarabdha will all cease to exist only when ego ceases to exist. Why? Because when ego ceases to exist, there's no one to do any agamya, because ego is the doer of agamya, and there's no one to experience any prarabdha, because ego is the experiencer of prarabdha. So that is our ultimate aim. So we can overcome prarabdha only by destroying ego. But in the meanwhile, this effort we are making to investigate ourselves, to the extent to which we are investigate ourselves, to that extent we won't be affected by our prarabdha, whatever it may be. Obviously, it's not nice having a headache. But there are so many experiences we have in life that are not nice. We have physical pain, we have mental pain, we have anguish, we have all sorts of problems we face in life. These all come according to prarabdha, and however much we may want to change them, we cannot change them. So the only wise thing to do is to let the prarabdha take its own course. We should turn our attention within and try to find out, who am I? To the extent to which we turn our attention within, to that extent, we are not attending to whatever is we are destined to experience. The experience will go on, but we will be unconcerned about it because we're not attending to it. We're attending only to I, the one to whom this experience appears. So, Bethune, I hope that that helps to answer that question. As with whatever experiences may occur during self-investigation, whether it's a painful experience like a headache or a blissful experience like peace or some great, very sublime, whatever sublime or horrible experiences may occur, to whom do they occur? We should turn our attention back to ourselves and be unconcerned about either the pleasures or the pains that may occur according to prarabdha. Whatever we experience is according to prarabdha. Why should we be concerned about it? Who am I, the experiencer? To whom do all these experiences occur? That we're not just to ask ourselves the questions. Bhagavan gave these pointers in the form of questions, but then what is he pointing at? Only towards ourselves. He says, if one investigates to whom do these thoughts appear, it will be clear to me. That means our attention turns back towards ourselves. And holding on to that self-attentiveness, that is investigating who am I. So it's not a matter of questioning, but of actually investigating, seeing what we actually are. We can see what we actually are only by attending to ourselves. And then the final question was asked by was asked by Harish Subramaniam. What Harish asks is, what is Vishayavasana? Inherent tendencies. Vishaya means, in this context, Vishaya means all phenomena are Vishayas. It's a Sanskrit term, but in this context, it means phenomena of any kind whatsoever, whether physical phenomena or mental phenomena. So whether, however gross or subtle the phenomena may be, any phenomena is a Vishaya. So anything other than ourselves, anything that appears or disappears is a Vishaya. Vasana means an inclination. So our inclination to attend to and to experience phenomena, things other than ourselves, are what are called Vishaya Vasanas. Vasanas are often translated as tendencies. That's not entirely wrong, but it doesn't quite adequately capture it, because you can have a tendency. For example, some people have a tendency to stammer or stutter. They don't want to stammer or stutter, but it's just a tendency they have. A vasana is not a tendency like that. A vasana is an inclination. Vasana means if you actually like to stammer or stutter, then you can say you've got an inclination to stammer or stutter. We don't like to stammer or stutter. It just happens to be a tendency that we have. So there's a difference between tendencies and inclinations. Vasanas means inclinations. A synonym for vasana in Sanskrit is samskara. Samskaras and vasanas are two terms that refer to the same thing. They refer to our inclinations. But a lot of people who explain the older texts, they're people who have not put this into practice. So they don't have a practical understanding. So such people often confuse vasanas and samskaras. One way it's translated is tendency. That's not going too far wrong. Another way it's translated as impression. Vasanas are quite different to impressions. For example, memories are impressions. You experience something. Yesterday you ate a particular meal, or you went to see a particular cinema, or you heard a lecture, or you had some experience yesterday that left an impression on your mind, so you can recall it today. So all memories are impressions, but vasanas are something much deeper than memories. And some people even refer to vasanas are said to exist. Vasanas or samskaras are said to exist in the chittam. Chittam means the will, but chittam is often translated as memories, because they take the vasanas or samskaras to be impressions, and therefore they confuse them with memories, and therefore they refer to the chittam as memory. Chittam does not mean memory. Chittam means the will. And another the vasanas are also said to reside in the anandamaya kosha. So the anandamaya kosha is the chittam. It is not the memory. It is the will. That is the totality of all our vasanas is what is called the will. Because the vasanas, when vasanas sprout, they sprout in the form of likes, dislikes, desires, attachments, and so on. So the whole will. The will in its seed form is called vasanas or samskaras. In its sprouted form, it's called likes, dislikes, desires, attachments, hopes, fears, and so on. So this is all the will. This is what the chittam consists of. This is what the anandamaya kosha consists of. It's nothing but these vasanas that give rise to the likes and dislikes and so on. So the vasanas are inclinations. So when you have an inclination to attend to anything other than yourself, that is a Vishaya Vasana. And the Vishaya Vasanas are the obstacles that we're up against when we try to turn our attention within. Because we've got strong inclination to attend to things other than ourselves, we when we allow ourselves to be swayed by our vishaya vasanas, in other words, when we allow ourselves to be swayed by our inclinations, we attend to things other than ourselves. So attending to anything other than ourselves, we do so under the sway of our vishaya vasanas. But vasanas are only inclinations. We are not bound by our inclinations. I may have an inclination to do some bad thing. I may have an inclination to, or something that's not good for me. I may have an inclination to overeat, for example. But just because I have an inclination to overeat doesn't mean that I'm made to overeat. I am free either to allow myself to be swayed by that inclination and therefore to overeat, or to not be allowing myself to be swayed by it. So we always are free to be swayed or not swayed by our vishaya vasanas. So in order to turn our attention within, we need to use our freedom to not be swayed by our vishaya vasanas, but be swayed only by the sat vasana, the inclination just to be as we actually are. So that's why Bhagavan devoted two entire paragraphs in Nana to this subject of vishaya vasana, the 10th and 11th paragraphs. I don't have time to go through them now, but it's the vishaya vasana means our inclination to attend to anything other than ourselves. When we're attending to ourselves, we are not allowing ourselves to be swayed by those inclinations. So I hope this adequately answered that question about vishaya vasanas. I'm sorry I don't have time to elaborate more on the subject, but I think now I've come to the end of the time limit, I believe. Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Arunachala Ramanaya.